This is Ozarks at Large. When Michelle Norris began a project about discussing race in America, she didn't know what she might find. The co-host of NPR's All Things Considered discovered stories from her own family she'd never heard. A grandmother who toured across the country as the personification of the commercial character Aunt Jemima. She also learned her father had been shot by a white policeman during a scuffle in post-war Alabama. The result of her work is her new memoir, The Grace of Silence, an often touching recollection of growing up in Minnesota, watching her parents lead separate lives, and her own research into her family's history. Michelle Norris, welcome to Ozarks at Large.
It's great to be here.
You had an idea of what you wanted to pursue when you started this project, but it quickly took a turn, didn't it, when you began to find out these stories about your family?
Yes, a sharp left turn. I started writing a book about the hidden conversation on race in America. It was following the 2008 election, and I was convinced that there was this interesting and robust conversation that was often out of earshot. It was taking place in private places, and I wanted to listen in and write a series of essays about what I heard. But when I started listening very intently to the conversation in my own family, I learned a series of profound secrets. And I thought that maybe these would be anecdotes in the book that I was originally intending to write, but over time they just got up on my back and they wouldn't let go. And it became sort of my grand obsession, and I realized fairly deep into the process that I was writing the wrong book. And so I switched gears and changed course and decided to go where my curiosity would take me to try to learn more about what I had learned and to learn more about my racial legacy, and in doing so learn more about this country's racial history.
The episode with your father when he was shot in Alabama was something that was rarely mentioned in any part of your family. It was almost a secret.
Well, it was never mentioned in my household. I mean, I grew up with my father, of course, and stayed with my father when my mother and father divorced. I was very close to his family. He's from Birmingham, Alabama. I spent a lot of time in Birmingham, almost every summer in my youth, going down to visit my grandparents. He had five brothers. There were six sons from Birmingham. All of them had moved north. I was very close to all of them, very close to my cousins, and never heard a word of this. And, you know, nor did my mother. I mean, my mother was married to my father for several years before they were divorced in the late 70s. They remained good friends even after their divorce, and she never heard of this. So she learned this, you know, at the same time that I did. So it was something that he put away, and I wanted to understand not just what happened, but why he put that secret away, and then what that meant for me, and what that kind of what those secrets mean for all of us, because our story is not unique in that sense. Families have secrets. And a lot of times when parents go through difficulties, they don't necessarily want to talk about those difficulties with their children. And I realize that particularly when it comes to that thorny period in America where we as a country were trying to figure out, you know, how to deal with integration and how to dispense with segregation and how to figure out how to live with each other. It was a very painful period. And a lot of people on both sides of the color line moved forward and just stopped talking about it, didn't share those stories. So I was trying to explore my own story, but I was also trying to figure out what America was going through at that time and how much we really don't know, even now, about that period before the civil rights era. We think of it as marches and everyone singing We Shall Overcome in this sort of truncated period in the late 1960s, but there was an awful lot that happened before that that is missing from our history books and missing from our memory banks.
And it's no more realized than when you talk to a woman you had never met before, Julia Beaton, and she talks about walking on Sunday at church to or from, and people throwing rotten fruit. And she, there is a lot of that unknown history that you found out by talking to her.
Yeah. Julia Beaton lived a few doors down from my grandparents on Avenue G in Birmingham. And her older brother, John, was actually with my father the night that he was shot in that scuffle with Alabama police officers. And what she was talking about was my grandparents, my Grandpa Belvin and my Grandma Fanny walking home from a church revival. They attended a church that was not far from their home, and they were walking home and they were wearing all white. And Julia remembers very vividly and very deeply, because this was a very painful experience for her, even though she only watched it, a group of a car full of young men, she said. She thought they were maybe teenagers, maybe young adults. And they threw rotten tomatoes at my grandparents, who were dressed in white from head to toe. And Julia, in talking about that, was you could hear her trembling. And you could feel her rage in just remembering it. And you could also feel her pain. And it's something that obviously still lives inside her. And it was really something for me to hear that, because my father, having been through his experience, never revealed that kind of rage to me. And I'm you know, not sure that if it did live inside of him, I never saw that. And so she's in the book in part because she spoke so honestly and so candidly about her pain. But she's also there to show through, I guess, the juxtaposition of those experiences, how different people choose to move forward. And one of the things that was so amazing to me about my father and this generation of veterans that were marginalized in the military and sometimes brutalized when they returned from war is that they had lots of reasons to be angry at the world and very disappointed in their country. And instead of moving forward with anger, they decided to step forward with hope and ambition, and they tried to pass that hope and that ambition on to their children. They didn't want the next generation to be weighed down with anger and to be disappointed in a country that they still believed in. And that's where that title comes from, The Grace of Silence, because it takes a lot of grace and a good deal of fortitude to do something like that, to put away your own emotions for the benefit of your children.
And for a project that began that was going to explore discussions about race, what I come away with after reading The Grace of Silence is there are still a lot of discussions we're not having.
Oh, well, you know, race is something that's hard to talk about. It's not easy for all kinds of reasons. We sometimes are afraid of saying the wrong thing. It's a difficult history in this country, and we're afraid of opening that door because you just don't know what's going to fall out. And we expect, I think, in a lot of ways, particularly after the 2008 election, that there's going to be some grand national conversation. And I come away from this project with a very strong belief that the most productive conversations about race don't take place in public spaces. And if everyone is expecting us to have a big national conversation where we all sit down at 4 p.m. on a Saturday afternoon and all talk about race at the same time, you know, that's just never going to work for all kinds of reasons. But if people talk about it in more private settings, in the workspace, at their own kitchen table, with someone that you know and trust, I think it's possible to have an open, meaningful, productive conversation. And sometimes that conversation is going to be painful, particularly if people are really, truly honest mm-hmm. about their beliefs or their experiences. But it's worth it, and that's where the fortitude comes on, to stay at that table, even if someone says something that you don't believe in or someone says something to you that maybe is offensive, to try to stay at the table and understand where they're coming from.
The name of the book is The Grace of Silence. Michelle Norris, thank you so much for your time.
Good to be with you. Thanks so much.
Michelle Norris is the co-host of NPR's All Things Considered. Her new book, The Grace of Silence, is available beginning today. This is Ozarks at Large. In many Arkansas towns, this is Election Day. School board seats will be determined, as will, in some cities, the fate of proposed millage measures. In Springdale, voters are being asked today to approve a $2.4 million increase to build new schools and facilities. In Fayetteville, voters will be deciding on a $2.75 million increase to help fund a redesign of the city's high school. Polls remain open until 7:30 tonight. In 42 days, another election. This one will determine the state's races for U.S. Senate, all four of Arkansas's congressional seats, the state's constitutional offices, and hundreds of county and city races. A new poll this week suggests Republican Congressman John Bozeman still has a big lead over incumbent Democrat Blanche Lincoln in her bid for a third term in the U.S. Senate. Roby Brock, the publisher of Talk Business Quarterly and the website talkbusiness.com, helped organize the latest poll. He reports on the latest poll numbers today and talks with two Arkansas bloggers from opposite sides of the political spectrum, Jason Tolbert from the right-leaning TolbertReport.com and Matt Campbell from the left-leaning BlueHogReport.com. He talked first with Jason Tolbert about the latest poll numbers in the U.S. Senate race.
Well, we really haven't seen the numbers change. Lincoln has not been able to bring her number up at all. She's done quite a bit this last month. She's had several commercials that she's rolled out. She's traveled the district. She's talked a lot about the federal funds that she's secured for Arkansas projects. That has not helped her. Her numbers have remained in the low 30s. Bozeman's number has hovered in the mid-50s, coming in close to 60%. So all the strategy she's trying has not resonated with the voters. And she's really just kind of treading water at this point.
All right, Matt, anything in our poll that jumps out at you in the U.S. Senate race?
Two things. First, the not surprising part about how the health care bill just doesn't play here. I know people have tried to make the case that it benefits the state, but it's not, that message isn't getting through in the least that I can see. The other one that was somewhat shocking was that her role as an agriculture chair didn't seem to have much of an effect at all. People didn't really care, at least as it showed up in the actual results between she and Bozeman.
Now, Mason Dixon Polling conducted a survey of 625 likely voters this past week and included the Arkansas's governor race. The results showed that Governor Mike Beebe is ahead of his Republican challenger, Jim Keat, by 21 points. Beebe led Keat 54-33% in the head-to-head matchup. Green Party candidate Jim Lindell polled at 2%, and 11% were undecided. Back to our bloggers from the left, Matt Campbell at Blue Hog Report goes first. Tell me, do you think Governor Mike Beebe, you think he's safe in your estimation?
This is probably the only race other than the only state race where it's done. I can't comprehend how Keith can even realistically think he has a shot at this point. I mean, I'd say that kind of tongue-in-cheek, but $2.5 million, he's already bought the media that he was planning on buying. He's got the money to own the next 45 or 60 days, however long he needs. And that kind of lead, he's over 50% as an incumbent, that one is done.
Well, obviously it's good news for Governor Beebe. He's put, I think, roughly $750,000 down on TV, and it hasn't even started running yet. So obviously that's going to be a very large media buy. Jim Keat's taken out over $100,000 in loans. He's already spent that money, and he's out of cash again. So it's going to be almost an impossible uphill climb for him to compete, at least on a media level, on a media a campaign structure level that Beebe has put together. Will the generic ballot help Jim Keat? I think it will help him some. I think this is one of the first years in Arkansas politics where it actually helps you to be a Republican, to have the R after your name on the ballot. And I think that will give him a boost, and we'll see this race tighten as well. But I think Beebe may be one of the only Democrats people check when they go into the ballot box this year. And I think he will probably carry some support from people who vote for one Democrat in the race and vote Republicans in the rest of the races.
Now, Tolbert mentioned the Republican generic ballot trend we're seeing this year. Talk Business has also polled the strength of party identification this cycle versus candidate name identification. As we've reported, there is a surge of enthusiastic GOP voters that has translated to leads in many races that some speculate is purely party affiliated. But between now and Election Day, candidates are likely to advertise their efforts for your vote, identifying themselves by name only, not party. For instance, John Bozeman, a Republican, doesn't mention the fact in his ad. Neither does Blanche Lincoln mention that she's a Democrat. So we polled the theory on the down-ballot constitutional officer elections. The first poll for Lieutenant Governor, Secretary of State, and Land Commissioner with party affiliation in the questioning. If the election for Lieutenant Governor were today, which candidate would you support? Democrat Shane Broadway got 27%. Republican Mark Darr got 44%. 29% are undecided. If the election for Secretary of State were today, which candidate would you support? 50.5% said Republican Mark Martin. 32% said Democrat Pat O'Brien, 17.5% undecided. If the election for Commissioner of State lands were today, which candidate would you support? 49% said Republican John Thurston, 24.5% said Democrat L.J. Bryant, 26.5% are undecided. So next we polled the same races with no party ID and got very different results. If the election for Lieutenant Governor were today, which candidate would you support? Shane Broadway got 17%, Mark Darr 11%, and a whopping 72% are undecided. If the election for Secretary of State were today, which candidate would you support? Again, with no party identification. Mark Martin, 13.5%. Pat O'Brien, 23.5%. Undecided, 63%. If the election for Commissioner of State lands were today, which candidate would you support? Only 9.5% for John Thurston, 15% for L.J. Bryant, 75.5% undecided. Those are some dramatic differences. So, party ID versus name ID, which is going to win out on election day? Back to our bloggers, Jason Tolbert first, followed by Matt Campbell.
Well, I think this year, the further down the ballot you go, the more the generic advantage will help Republicans. People tend to tune in more to those higher races, to the Senate race, to the governor's race. When you get to lieutenant governor, when you get to Secretary of State, I don't think people pay as close attention to those races. I think on the name ID, I don't think anybody's spent a lot of money yet. So I'm not surprised to see a huge number of undecideds in all of those races. You do see about a 10-point advantage for Republicans from the polling data that I've seen. Whether the Democrats can overcome that deficit when they begin to spend money is really going to be the question. They've all had healthy fundraising numbers. Both Shane Broadway, Pat O'Brien had a good, healthy financial report that they filed this week. So can they use those funds to make up the deficit really is going to be the question.
I would assume that eventually you're going to have some kind of something that people can identify with, or at least know why they are voting for you. You know, relying on them to vote against your opponent isn't the best strategy that I could imagine, especially with somebody like John Thurston, who, I mean, 9 out of 10 Arkansans probably couldn't pick him out of a police lineup. There's no name recognition there. When we take the party ID away, he drops from somewhere around 50% down to about 8%. So contrast that with L.J. Bryant, who has name recognition because of the heated runoff with Monty Davenport. Bryant has proposed some technological advances, has some ideas. I can't imagine that Thurston is just going to be able to run as a generic Republican on the actual ballot and do much when November 2nd rolls around.
Matt Campbell is the publisher of the liberal BlueHogReport.com. And we also heard from Jason Tolbert of the conservative TolbertReport.com. There is more of their conversation with Roby Brock, including an analyzation of the latest numbers on the race for Arkansas's first congressional district. That's at OzarksAtLarge.com. Support for Roby Brock's coverage of Arkansas business and politics is provided by Hendricks College, a residential undergraduate liberal arts college. Learn more at hendricks.edu/odyssey. And the Little Rock National Airport at fly-lit.com, where travelers can book air, car, and hotel reservations online, track flights, and check the weather. Mobile phone access is also available at fly-lit.com/mobile. And Bank of the Ozarks, offering the tools and services to make Arkansas businesses work. More information is available at bankozarks.com. This is Ozarks at Large. The Arkansas chapter of the National Trail of Tears Association hosted We Remember this month at the Town Center in Fayetteville to commemorate the forced removal of the Cherokees from their land base in the 1830s. For centuries, the Cherokees had lived in villages in the southern Appalachian Mountains, places like present-day Virginia, West Virginia, the Carolinas, Kentucky, Tennessee, and northeastern Alabama. Prior to removal, the Cherokee had constructed European-style homes and farmsteads, developed a written language, established a newspaper, and enacted a constitution. But as Indians, they were not guaranteed equal protection under the law, so could not prevent whites from seizing their lands. They were driven from their homes, herded into internment camps, and moved by force from the southeastern U.S. to Indian territory, present-day Oklahoma. An estimated 4,000 Cherokee died from hunger, exposure, and disease during this transition. The Trail of Tears National Historic Trail was designated as a National Historic Trail by Congress in 1987. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich attended the September 11th We Remember gathering, and she brings us the story and sounds of the Cherokee National Youth Choir.
Well, I'm Mary Kay Henderson, and I'm the director of the Cherokee National Youth Choir. The Cherokee National Youth Choir began in 2000 as a language initiative among the Cherokees, trying to revitalize the Cherokee language. And we decided the best place to start was through our young people. I was not involved with the choir at that time, but Jan Ballou and Jamie Geneva were the directors at that time. Principal Chief Chad Smith, this was his dream. And in 2003, myself and Kathy Sierra became the directors. We have auditions the first Tuesday of January of the new year. And you have to call and set up an appointment if you want to come and audition for that choir. You can call 918-453-5638 if you're interested in auditioning. You just have to be able to make weekly rehearsals in Tahlequah and be a registered member of the Cherokee tribe. And be in at least the sixth grade, getting ready to go into seventh grade. And through a senior in high school, we have about 40 students usually in the choir. Then we end up with about 30 at every event.
Right. Hi, my name is Natalie Tomasek. I'm 15 years old. This is my third year in the choir, and I really enjoy it. It's a good way to know my language and my culture, and to also have the honor of wearing the traditional dress. And I could be just sitting at home, but instead I'm here in Arkansas singing, performing in front of a bunch of people. So it's a good honor.
The students are wearing traditional Cherokee tear dresses, and they are made from calico. You'll hear people call them tear dresses or tear dresses because they are kind of tiered, as you'll notice. But I was always told back in the day that the pieces were torn. They're all rectangles. And so they were so that they could take a piece of fabric and they could tear it into the rectangles, and that formed the different pieces of the dress. And so that's why they're called tear dresses. They're usually in calico, and then the adornment is made by taking away. You'll notice the cut work, it's cut out, and they use ribbons also, and we'll add a little adornment. And then the students are wearing their corn bead necklaces and other beaded necklaces that they, some of them have. How many of you made your own corn bead necklace, okay, that you have on? And so they made those, and they learn how to do a lot of different things. They can make baskets and corn husk dolls, and what are some other things we do? They fix earrings. We have some in there around our table for sale. They do pinch pots, all kinds of different things that they learn how to do as part of the choir.
Agis telestia.
the National Youth Choir in a live performance singing in their native language. You can learn more at youthchoir.cherokee.org, and you can visit the National Trail of Tears website at nationaltota.org. And you can find any link we mentioned in this program at our website, ozarksatlarge.com.
Baby, I've been here before. I know this room. I walk this floor.
Canadian singer-songwriter Leonard Cohen was born on this date in 1934 in Montreal. Already established as a poet and novelist, Cohen became interested in the Greenwich Village folk scene while living in New York City during the mid-1960s. He began setting his poems to music, and in 1967, Judy Collins recorded two of his songs, Suzanne and Dress Rehearsal Rag. That same year, Cohen began performing in public. By the end of 1967, he had recorded the album The Songs of Leonard Cohen, which included Hey, That's No Way to Say Goodbye. That album was followed by Songs from a Room and Songs of Love and Hate. Though some did not care for Cohen's baritone voice and deadpan delivery, he mostly enjoyed critical and commercial success. His career then took a decided turn for the worse with the release of the album Death of a Ladies' Man. For most of the 1980s, Cohen was out of favor, but his 1988 album I'm Your Man included the club hits First We Take Manhattan and Everybody Knows, and introduced his songwriting to a new generation. After releasing The Future in 1992, he retired to a Buddhist monastery outside of Los Angeles. He emerged in 1999 and returned to the studio, producing 10 new songs and Dear Heather. In 2005, Cohen discovered his business manager had embezzled some $5 million from his savings, virtually wiping out his retirement fund. While he won a $7.9 million judgment against her the following year, Cohen was unable to recover the money, and he embarked on a concert tour, his first in 15 years, in 2008, to rebuild his finances. One performance from that tour was recorded for the two-disc set Live in London. In 2008, Cohen was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and in 2010, he was honored with a Lifetime Achievement Grammy Award. The first Daisy Airgun Museum was dedicated on this date in 1966. The museum consisted of six upright cases and two flat display cases housing antique airguns from Europe, as well as an excellent representation of Daisy Manufacturing's product dating to the 1880s. The current Daisy Airgun Museum in historic downtown Rogers attracts visitors from all over the world, due in part to the popularity of the Daisy BB gun that was once a staple of childhood in America. People visit in order to experience Daisy's history and to buy unique collectibles and souvenirs. Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. On this date in 1897, the New York Sun ran an editorial that answered a question from 8-year-old Virginia O'Hanlon, is there a Santa Claus? For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
He lives and lives forever.
It is Tuesday, September 21st, 2010. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is Becca Bacon-Martin, editor of What's Up? And what is up?
I've got to quit listening to you do the dates.
Does it scare you?
Well, you know, I'm still back in July somewhere. But there will be other lost people on Dixon Street tonight, because there's a tequila tasting at 6 p.m. at the Walton Art Center, part of the Art of Wine series now.
Mm-hmm.
And tickets are $75.
Let me tell you that for years I disregarded tequila. I thought it was something that dumb college students drank in excess when they went on spring break.
Mm-hmm.
I just did not have an appreciation. Then I had a friend who introduced me to very good tequila, and there are varieties that are very, very good.
So you will learn things at the tequila tasting that you didn't know.
I would assume so, yes.
Okay. I'm picturing the one unfortunate night when I got into a tequila shot contest
child. You know, that's just not the real world of good tequila.
Okay. So with Kyle's endorsement, or there's an alt-country band called American Aquarium. from North Carolina, and they'll be playing at 7 o'clock tonight at New Orleans Landry's New Orleans Cafe in Fort Smith.
Perfect.
And they'll be at George's Majestic Lounge in Fayetteville at 10 o'clock on Thursday.
You can see them twice if you'd like.
Yes.
Becca, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kyle.
Becca Bacon-Martin is the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers. This is Ozarks at Large. Tomorrow night, autumn arrives. To mark the opening of fall, we're spending some time this week discussing other great openings. Yesterday, John Jetter, the musical director of the Fort Smith Symphony, picked great opening moments in music. Today, P.J. Hrabowski will talk with David Lewis, the executive chef of the Brick House Kitchen at the corner of 11th and South School Avenue in Fayetteville. He discussed both how to open a specific meal and how to open a seasonal menu for a restaurant. PJ asked David to imagine a food critic from the New York Times has walked into his restaurant today and asked to be wowed. David Lewis says, given that scenario, he would work from his current menu.
Starting with some bits of cheese with our homemade crackers, and then... for example, right now we're at the close of our summer menu, and you know we're at the last of the ratatouille. Mm-hmm. So the late summer peppers are really sweet, and we're at the last mm-hmm. of the squashes. You know, and we're actually serving that with the Pecorino Oro Antico, which is a beautiful aged sheep's milk cheese from Italy. That sort of then ties into the idea of cheese as well. And so we would have that warm ratatouille with the cheese on top of it, and some sort of earthy, stinky blue cheese with some currants and brandy, and then. Maybe just a little tiny sampling of our chef de cuisine, Lisa Jeter's cucumber soup, because it's still a little warm outside, and the soup is cool with just a little bit of heat from some jalapenos from the Brick House Kitchen Garden, which is a great thing to be able to say as well. And so that introduction would be about the idea of little combinations of flavors and textures that represented our ideas of things from around the world that are delicious, from some things that we craft in-house by hand, like our little handmade crackers that we're doing right now, I think are really special. But also this combination of temperatures as well. And so being able to take, you know, a piece of warm pepper and follow that of warm pepper from the ratatouille that's actually heat warm, you know, from the oven with a little bit of gooey cheese on the top and following that with a really cool, you know, spoonful of cucumber soup that sort of washes the warmth away, but then finishes it with just a little bit of heat from the chili. So we have heat in two different ways. And then following that with, you know, some earthy, gooey, you know, stinky, barnyardy, you know, cheese with a homemade poppy seed cracker.
You know, and it's lunchtime, so we're all salivating. We're all salivating, going, okay, what next? Okay, so this is the appetizer. So it's kind of a sampler of different things.
Exactly.
Which sounds wonderful.
Exactly. And I think one of the things that in the way that we present our dinner menu is not to separate courses out. I mean, we have one piece of paper that has... Under a dish heading, a variety of ways of sort of allowing that dish to appear before you as a first course, as a salad, as an entree, and so that first episode would be about that idea of sort of being able to compose your own way through these choices.
Okay,
you
so
know, that we have done.
So you've started with heat, and then cool, and then heat. Right?
Yes.
Okay, so what follows that?
Then I get challenged because there are two big overarching ideas that are sort of present in our food right now. And one is the idea of representing healthful, nourishing food grown in sustainable ways, often by local people, and are doing really interesting things to it that really try to treat those really great ingredients as simply as possible so they can be what they are. And the other is this fascination that I in particular have with flavor combinations from around the world. You know, and so I would look at our summer menu that we're just about to close and open the fall menu in October. And I would struggle in choosing two dishes.
Okay.
One that Lisa designed for us for this menu, which is very representative of her creativity, our sort of collaborative view of taking a traditional idea, spinning it around the globe, and then trying to get inside of it and simplify it in a way that allows each of the flavors and textures to be present. And that dish is the tandoori scallops. You know, and I think of tandoori traditionally as that beautiful Indian dish of marinating meats and vegetables and yogurt and this tandoori spice, and then cooking it in the tandoori oven. And that presence of the yogurt and the cream, you know, is a really magical thing. And what Lisa's done, however, is pull that spice blend, the tandoori spice blend, out of the yogurt and cream.
Okay.
And so that yogurt, that cooling thing, that presence that you get from the yogurt isn't in this dish at all, but that really beautiful, clear, complex set of flavors from the tandoori spice that she crafts is dusted on the scallops and they're pan-seared. It's sprinkled on the bacon, so we have scallops and bacon,
okay,
and this really sort of traditional American combination.
Okay.
But the bacon is cooked independently, and it's first oven roasted with the spices on it, and then re-roasted again so that it's crisp when it goes on the plate. And then we took the idea of a summer succotash, but used the vegetables that we could get.
Okay.
So we were using corn and cabbage and a little bit of red pepper, and folding that into forbidden rice, which is this beautiful, tiny black rice from Japan.
And it's called forbidden rice?
It's called forbidden rice. Yeah. That's just like arborio rice, you know, from Italy. This is forbidden rice. And it's a beautiful visual presence, you know, on the plate. So it's just charcoal black, and then we've got the yellow of the corn and this sort of yellowy oil that's coming off of the tandoori scallops.
And the wonderful spices.
Exactly. And the amazing thing is it sounds like a very, very complicated dish. Mm-hmm. But when it's put in front of you, it's really not. You know, and when you get it on your palate, it all fits together. The other dish, which I think is one of the most incredible dishes that we have on the current menu, is a dish of cannellini beans and whole oat groats with fresh fennel and purple onions in a smoked tomato vinaigrette. And this dish is an example of what happens when Lisa and I stand at the two ends of the kitchen and put a plate in the center of the room, you know, and start, you know, one of us will sort of put a card on the plate, and then the other will respond to that. And then we walk around and we flip it up and we'll often then hang it on the wall and we'll come back to it days later and see sort of how it's looking, you know, conceptually. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's also, you know, a representative of my exploration of really nourishing food. You know, whole oat groats are one of the most nutritious, you know, things that you
yummy.
Can get. And we're all used to having oatmeal for breakfast, but this grain is an extraordinary thing in the savory kitchen, and as a component of a side dish, or in this case as a main course, it's really an amazing texture and flavor.
It sounds like two great dinners, David.
Thank you.
And just as a little side note, you do have a garden out there, don't you?
We do.
And so you grow it as much as you can.
Absolutely.
That you use. I mean, you walk out to the garden, grab your herbs and whatever veggies you can grow, and that's
one.
David Lewis, executive chef of Brick House Kitchen in Fayetteville. David, come back. Can we talk about food some more?
I would love that. Thank you very much.
David, we'll be back. For Ozarks at Large, I'm PJ Hrabowski.
And David Lewis should soon know more about openings. He's planning to open a second location next month inside Nightbird Books on Dixon Street in Fayetteville. And online at OzarksAtLarge.com, you can hear David talk to PJ about a couple of great ways to end a meal. He discusses desserts that he would serve with the meals he described today, including a dish he calls chocolate soup.
And the chocolate is melted in a little bit of water, a little bit of red wine, and a little bit of maple syrup, just enough to sort of sweeten it slightly. And there's just enough red wine in there to sort of link it from acidity to the cake. So there's this puddle of chilled chocolate soup, and then the cake is in the center.
Desserts online at OzarksAtLarge.com. And speaking of openings, the University of Arkansas Fort Smith Academy of the Arts has recently opened for another school year. This fall's new offerings for young people include classes in the Suzuki method of violin, a theater company for 7th, 8th, and 9th graders called Extremes Teens, and a flute choir. Dr. Rosalie Walker-Russell is the executive director of the academy, located on the UAFS campus.
You know, we want kids to say, hey, as a child, I go to UA Fort Smith Academy. It's like a little university child, you know. And we want to help kids find a place to connect. I'm a big fan of sports. I was an athlete, and I love sports. And kids who are in sports have found a place to connect. There are a lot of kids who are not in sports, and they maybe don't have a place to connect at school, and the arts programs are perfect for that. So we want children to find that place to connect through what we do. We also do far more than just teach them art or music. We're trying to develop some life skills in these kids. Some of them have no role model at home. Some of them do. Parents who are actively involved in their kids' lives in the academy, they're wonderful parents, great help to us. But we do try to develop, you know, other skills so they become a total person in their lifestyle and in everything that they do. That's part of what we try to help with. And then my personal endeavor is that we are, I'm just strict about this, that we are going to help these kids improve in their academics. Meaning their grades are going to get better. We actually have an assessment program where we assess the kids yearly on their grades and their benchmark tests and their attendance so that we can show over a five-year period of time that many of these kids now are not missing school, their focus is better, their grades have improved. There are national studies that have clearly proven that the arts do that. So that's one of our big things. And then we also want these kids to go to college. Not necessarily, you know, in an arts program. Some of them are just going to do this for fun, you know. But we want to see kids, all kids, go to college. I mean, to me, education is the ticket to your future. And so we try to encourage that. And through the academy, we can help encourage that.
Early next month, the first Saturday in October, the UA Fort Smith Academy of the Arts will offer a full day of fundraising opportunities. You can sing, you can dance, you can play an instrument, you can just run. Again, Rosalie Walker-Russell.
Saturday morning, October 2nd at 10 a.m., we're doing a run walk. We're calling it Run for the Arts. It's a 5K out at Fort Chaffee, and they can go to our website and download a registration form. And it's open to ages 10 and up, and we'll have age categories and awards, you know, first place awards in all the different age groups. It just so happens that there's the Survivors 5K run that morning at 8 at somewhere around Creekmore Park. So we're encouraging those serious runners to do the 5K at 8, then head on over to Fort Chaffee and do the 5K at 10.
If you're really
coming on,
if you're really serious, finish that one at, and then just run to Fort Chaffee and then complete that 5K.
That ought to get you a marathon.
Just about, yeah, or if not, a little bit more.
Yeah, so that's that morning, and all of the proceeds for that run will go to scholarships for the kids. Well, from noon on that day, from about 12 to 4 in the afternoon, we have a big talent competition, and that's for ages 5 through adults. And we're calling that the Perform for the Arts, and that'll be right there on UA Fort Smith campus in the Campus Center Reynolds Room. And again, they can go to the website and download a registration form. The categories for that are voice, instrumental, and dance. And students can even register for a duet, trio, quartet, and register for more than one category. And ages 5 all the way through adults, we'll take those adults and have a fun talent competition. And again, the proceeds for that go to scholarships for the kids. So that's coming up October 2nd, an all-day kind of thing. You could run your way on over to the school and sing a tune after you finish your 5K.
Dr. Rosalie Walker-Russell is the Executive Director of the University of Arkansas Fort Smith Academy of the Arts on the UA Fort Smith campus. You can learn more at uafortsmith.edu/academy. And you can find any link that we mention on the program at our webpage, ozarksatlarge.com. Ozarks at Large is supported by the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, dedicated to the celebration and documentation of the region's history and culture. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Berryville, a listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. KUAF has proudly served as your source for NPR programming for the past 25 years. Remember, you can listen online at KUAF.com. The Planet Jupiter cruise will take place tonight beginning at 5:30 at Lake Fort Smith State Park. Cruise along the waters of Lake Fort Smith and view a planetary rarity. The planet Jupiter will be the closest to Earth than it has been in 40 years. Reservations are suggested. You can make them still this afternoon at 369-1018. There is a cost for this evening's cruise. For more information, 369-2469. And the Reynolds Room of the Smith Pentagraph Campus Center will resonate with the sounds of the trombone tonight when the University of Arkansas Fort Smith presents an evening of trombone music. It's free, and it begins tonight at 7:30 and will feature classic trombone repertoire from Baroque works to modern trombone compositions. For more information, 788-7972. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for tuning in. Back tomorrow at noon with another brand new edition of Ozarks at Large. And don't forget, you can register for the Harvest Music Festival Getaway Giveaway. You can do that right now at our website, KUAF.com. Just click on Contest to enter the drawing. Please, just one entry per person. Thanks and good luck.